From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 393 for this April 15th, 2012. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call, broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. And we'll be taking your calls very soon at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number, and our lines are filling up right now, but a few lines left. More than happy to be speaking with you earlier on as it gives more opportunity to review things in detail and provide you with some interesting information and background material that you can use in making decisions for yourself about your own health issues and health care. And I wanted to review, before we get to the phone lines, just a couple of articles sort of not really to pick apart too much, but just to give you some background on how I interpreted some of this particular information. And this is entitled, the headline, it's from the Sunday Telegraph from last week. New vaccine targets 90% of cancer types. Molecule in cells can trigger immune system to respond. Which, you know, sounds pretty nice in that when you read through this article, it shows that they've trained a vaccine to seek out and destroy tumor cells by targeting a molecule that is found in 90% of cancers. It's sort of a common link between different cancer types, and in this case, including breast and prostate cancer. And these are preliminary results. This is a phase one trial. Now, phase one trial is not designed to show whether something works or not. It is designed to show whether something is safe to use in people. So it was not designed to show efficacy, only designed to show whether something is safe to use. And the data that is being shown, this is a new vaccine that's being developed called Imucin, developed at Tel Aviv University and also through a company called Vaxel Biotherapeutics. So again, this particular article is likely the product of a press release from this particular company and the university, as opposed to it being from a publication. And in fact, when you read further in the article, it says the results are still to be published formally. And on top of that, it says, but if further trials prove to be successful, the vaccine could be available within 6 years. Well, again, what you have to consider is this is a phase one trial. There are three phases to doing research. Phase two moves things forward and looks for efficacy in a very select population, some given the vaccine, others not given the vaccine, for particular cancers, and then they look at what happens over the long term. If that is successful, the next thing that they do is they go on to phase three trials, which are much larger trials. They may encompass more different types of cancer, different populations, different age groups. And if that is successful, then it goes on to various agencies for approval for use, where they have to make their case to show that there is enough evidence to say, you know what, we'll now incorporate this into our treatment regimen for cancer. So what they have claimed in here is that you had a particular form of cancer, only one kind that they did the testing for. And these were 10 patients suffering from multiple myeloma. It's a type of blood cancer that received the vaccine. Seven finished the treatment. And the company reports that they all had greater immunity against cancer cells compared with before they were given the vaccine. Again, the issue is, though, although they may have greater immunity against these cancer cells, we don't know if this improves survival. We don't know whether it improved their quality of life. All we know is that they developed antibodies against these particular cancer cells for a particular cancer. So again, when they have a headline that says new vaccine targets 90% of cancer types, you have to be very careful when you look at this because, again, the information came from the company. The information also came from the University of Tel Aviv, but it also doesn't fully represent in any shape or form that you're going to be able to treat 90% of cancers. It's certainly encouraging to read this preliminary research and see that this is moving along in a direction that's a little bit different. And it's nice to see that people are thinking outside the box and trying to incorporate different ways of approaching cancer treatment. But it's still not something that really you hang your hat on and you then say it will be available or potentially available in 6 years. There is so much more to go for this. Just look at what's at the University of Ottawa and the Ottawa Cancer Research Institute with Dr. John Bell and the cancer vaccines he's developing. And it's been going on for decades. And there's good success with it, but it's very slow, very methodical, and appropriately researched and published. And it does take a long time for this type of approach to really reach the patient in any significant way. So again, it's an interesting article, but really in terms of how it was presented, in terms of the headline, really is misrepresenting the, I would say, the in terms of the future, in terms of treating cancer. It's one of those things that might work, but certainly not the panacea that we're looking for, at least right now. We're going to take a small break now, because we do have four people who are waiting and we have still have two lines available, 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call and back with your calls in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
While this pressure, I don't understand. When all of my neighbors, I lend them a hand.
My bones really toss and turn. 580 CFRA Sunday House Call. Your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255. Or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
You're a new and better man. He helps you to understand.
And back to the phone lines, and a good afternoon to Marie in Ottawa.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm in my early 30s. Mm-hmm. I'm healthy. I'm athletic, and I have no history of anxiety or depression.
Mm-hmm.
I stopped nursing my baby around 7 months. I didn't wean her too much. She took to the bottle rather quickly.
Okay.
About a month later, I began to experience severe anxiety. And it came out of nowhere. I don't have any stressors in my life that would cause that.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a peaceful home life and so forth.
Okay.
I've had tests done. Thyroid's fine. I've been checked head to toe. And my doctor's recommended to put me on Cipralex.
Okay.
And I'm petrified to go on that. I don't know how long I really need to go on it. I don't know. I'm concerned about side effects. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's any relation to this anxiety to stopping nursing so abruptly. Because if I look at the timeline, it seems to fit into that somehow.
It certainly is possible. And again, when there are abrupt changes, that is somebody that has been otherwise doing just fine, and there's a sudden change without any specific either traumatic event or significant change in one's life, a loss of something that could trigger the anxiety that you're experiencing, you do have to look for underlying physical causes first because there's a sudden change. So included in those physical causes are exactly as you mentioned, you know, you were otherwise well until you stopped breastfeeding. And then a month later, things started to happen. And it can, when you do experience hormonal changes when you stop breastfeeding, because breastfeeding in and of itself stimulates various hormonal systems in order to maintain milk production. And so you can have drop-offs of various hormone levels that can lead to mood changes, just as for some unfortunate women, their menstrual cycles and the changes in estrogen and progesterone levels throughout their cycle can trigger monthly depressive illness, which is very real, and they suffer for want of their cycle, and that literally drives them around the bend. So it's certainly very possible. We don't have any evidence per se to date based on the history, but we have your history in and of itself that links that together.
Mm-hmm.
When you say you've had a complete workup done, have you seen, for example, an endocrinologist to look and see if there's any other hormonal system that might have changed as a result of the stoppage of breastfeeding, or has there been a consult made at least to ask that question?
No, I went to the doctor. I had an MRI done. I had a CAT scan done as well, and I just know numerous blood tests.
Okay, and why did they do the MRI and CAT scan?
Because I was describing myself feeling disoriented,
mm-hmm.
but I think they were just making sure there was nothing wrong there, but it was really the anxiety that was causing that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And is the anxiety to the point that it is interfering with your ability to function?
Oh, entirely. It's gotten progressively worse.
Okay. And really, there's nothing in terms of, as you mentioned, in terms of what's happening in your life to really cause the anxiety?
Nothing.
Okay. So what I would suggest is that to use a medication when there is no specific diagnosis is still not the best thing to do. Now, but at the same time, I don't want to interfere with any therapeutic suggestions your physician has made. But sure. At the same time, we still don't know why you're anxious.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know why you're anxious, because everything else is going just fine. And again, because there's been a sudden change and there really has not been any trauma that has resulted in the anxiety, and you don't have a history of anxiety.
Nothing.
Then I still would say that you need to have an appropriate assessment of any metabolic factors or endocrine factors that could contribute to this anxiety. There's something in this history that does not suggest psychiatric illness per se, and
mm-hmm.
that suggests that there is a psychiatric response, an emotional response to a possible physical problem. It still doesn't take away the fact that you have anxiety, and if anxiety can be treated with Cipralex, but it may not. The problem is that we don't know what's causing this in the first place,
mm-hmm.
and so although you may mask it, it may mask something that will eventually or potentially get worse over time or get better over time, because bodies do have a tendency to resolve issues on their own when given an appropriate amount of time, and then we won't know whether it was the Cipralex that helped you or whether your own body got better on its own and whether you used the medication for nothing.
The words that have been used are postpartum anxiety.
But that's postpartum anxiety
that.
Is you would expect something like that to occur within weeks of delivering your child, not 7 months after breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we tend to hear about postpartum depressions and such. That's usually, usually after 10 days, you have a period where you can have mood swings as a result of hormonal changes right after delivery.
And I didn't even have any of that.
Right. And so there's just something about this that just does not fit into the pattern of saying this is anxiety or an anxiety disorder, without understanding what actually is causing that anxiety. It would be a lot different, Marie, if you said, there's been some significant changes in my life. There's, lost a job, or my husband lost a job, or we're financially destitute, or we're in danger of losing our home, or my child is sick, or something has gone on, or there's been somebody in the family is ill, or there's been a death in the family. Then, you can say there's a trigger for something like that and the reaction is normal. But in the absence of any of that, mm-hmm. you have to really question, okay, why does this anxiety pop up? And part of it is you can have emotional responses to physical ailments. And a lot of times we make assumptions that it is a psychiatric illness. And for many people, it can be. I'm not downplaying any symptoms or any situation where someone has a psychiatric illness. The point I am making is that there are symptoms just as people can have pain in a certain area from an illness. They can also have an emotional response that is abnormal to a physical illness as well. Thyroid disease is a classic example of people who get depressed, or if they're hyperthyroid, they can be quite anxious.
Mm-hmm. They did check that because of that exact thing. Mm-hmm.
Right. But that doesn't preclude other hormonal functions that can cause that as well. And that's where I would probably ask for an endocrinologist to take a look at you, because they may be aware of other hormonal systems associated with either breastfeeding or just postpartum as well that sometimes can go awry and produce some of these symptoms. But at least then you have a complete picture of the possibilities that could lead to the anxiety. And if at the end they determine, you know, there's no, there's certain, we haven't found anything, you then at least have options about, okay, do I want to treat this or not? But the caveat to this, though, is that it may take some time to do that assessment. And so
that's the hard part, because it's really affecting my day-to-day life.
And that's it. So this is where if it's anxiety, again, treating this with Cipralex, if you treat anxiety with Cipralex, it's going to take at least 3 to 5 weeks before you even know it's going to help. It doesn't work right away. I really am not a fan of using anxiolytic medications, which can be habit forming and really are not going to be and can make you drowsy and interfere with cognitive functions and make and memory and such. So not a great medication to use. There are other medications for anxiety. Buspirone is one, which is not addictive, which isn't habit forming, which also helps for anxiety. So there are different medications in the context of how acute or severe this is affecting your life.
At the moment.
Yeah. So there is a conundrum about finding out exactly what's causing it and trying to assist you to be able to resume a normal life.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you should do is discuss options with your physician about treating the anxiety with ask about buspirone also. I mean, that is another medication specifically for anxiety, especially if you don't have any depressive symptoms. It's pure anxiety. And also at the same time, having a referral to endocrinology to look and see if there is something else that's contributing to this change that you've had.
Okay. All right.
All right. So I hope that was helpful for you.
It certainly was.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Dorkin.
You're very welcome, Marie.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372. Are the numbers to call. And we do have a few minutes before the break, so we're going to go speak to Diane in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I was just wondering, this Wednesday, you spoke about a test that you set up online, and then we take the test, and then we know which test to ask for when we go for our annual physical.
Right.
And I didn't catch it, and I can't seem to, I'm not very good at the computer, so I can't find anything on the computer.
Well, it's an app for the iPhone and the iPad.
Okay.
And it is called AHRQ.
AHRQ. So if I don't have an iPhone or an iPad, I can't use it.
It may be available for Android as well, so it may run on smartphones too, but it's not a program that runs, at least as far as I know, that runs on your PC or your Mac. I think it's an app that's being used. At least that's how I use it.
Okay.
But if you know somebody that has then they can download it. It's the full name is AHRQ is the first four letters.
AHRQ.
And then the next series of four letters is a space between there.
Okay.
EPSS.
EPS. For Sam?
Sam, two S's.
Okay. So I can get at it to the iPhone.
Yeah, go to the Apple App Store and you can download it for free and have a friend download it, and then you can use that in the context of when you go for your physical exam and speak to your physician.
Right.
And that should help determine what's needed, what will work, what will not work, and give you a bit of a hand that way.
Okay. So I go
AHRQ. Space.
Okay, and then
EPSS.
Okay, because I don't know why I had it. Okay, I have that up there.
Okay.
Great, I'll try that. Thank you very much. Have a nice Sunday.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye, Diane. And we're going to take a small break. 521 Talk, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. Back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Gotta meet the new boss by 8 a.m. The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late tonight again. Been told you gotta work to feed the soul, but I can't do this all on my own. No, I know I'm no Superman.
521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. And over to line 3, and good afternoon to Andrew in Ottawa.
Hi.
Hi.
I've got a question about coconut oil. I've been reading up on it, and it indicates that it can reduce belly fat and all kinds of other benefits, and certain oils aren't good for use. Some are.
Mm-hmm.
And there are also indications that there are, again, good things and bad things with regard to coconut oil that's naturally extracted from coconuts.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know what your opinion is of that, if you know about it.
Well, my understanding of it is that, as with any food, I'm very skeptical when claims are made about one particular product in terms of maintaining or treating or preventing a particular disease. As with any food, coconuts are real. There's certainly nothing wrong with eating coconuts. Probably quite healthy for you to have in small quantities because they're high in saturated fat. But nevertheless, it's usually not eaten solely. Usually there's other foods that people will combine. And as part of a mixed diet where you eat real food, stay away from processed foods, I'm sure it's quite healthy for you. But in terms of the claims being made for it, there is very little evidence to show that coconut oil does anything to prevent many diseases.
The anecdotal evidence of using coconut oil to prepare foods and to cook is based on the health of individuals in, I don't know, countries that use a lot of that.
Right,
and
but
also indicative that they don't have heart disease or stroke as we do in North America.
Right, except that it's anecdotal evidence. And anecdotal evidence means that it's not collected the way we normally would look at data. And it is likely that their diets include other things that contribute to their health. So again, we can't select one food out of their entire diet and correlate that with their overall health and say that the oil causes improved health. What we can say is that they consume coconuts and coconut oil along with many other foods that altogether may certainly contribute to better health. But we can't tease out one particular factor and say that that is ultimately responsible. And a good example of that is the Mediterranean diet, where people tend to not eat very much red meat. They tend to have lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, lots of salad, olive oil, chicken, fish, and they tend to have less heart disease and they tend to have healthier outcomes. But it's not just the one fruit. It's not just the one vegetable. It's not just the olive oil. It's the whole lifestyle combined that usually will contribute to a person's overall health. And so we have to be very careful when looking at how people eat, what they consume, and then draw conclusions saying that because they're doing this or because they're eating this one thing, the health outcome they have is because of that, is the result of that. And so, so go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say there's very often you hear of talk about chicken soup being good for you if you know you're not well and that kind of thing. And then later on you hear that, you know, it's true, even though it was anecdotal.
Right, but it becomes true because they've actually run through the normal study process in order to demonstrate why it's true. We have to be very careful. Anecdotal evidence usually leads to false conclusions. And though you can have a lot of different anecdotal events that happen, say out of 1,000 of them, and you know some of them might actually be correct. But in order to know that, you have to be able to determine whether that indeed is the case. Because if we then accept all anecdotal evidence from all sources as being initially true, that can lead to potential harm to people, especially if the bulk of them are not going to be true in the long run. So you definitely are going to find things that, you know, in the past people say were good for you. And you know, a classic one is eating fish is good for you. And you find it again in the Mediterranean diet. There's fish and there's oils and all kinds of other stuff that tend to be health promoting. So again, it is always important that we don't use anecdotal evidence as a means of policy, that is in terms of treating people, because it is not able to differentiate the disease process, who would benefit most, the dose that's required, the interactions it may have, the fact that someone may focus on a particular treatment that anecdotally seems to work and ignore other treatments that have evidence that they do work and end up harming themselves because they've ignored those treatments and done the anecdotal ones in and of themselves. So, you know, I'm all for people looking things up and trying to find things that are helpful for them. My main thing is I need to have evidence to demonstrate that that is indeed the case. People can choose what they want to do, and I'm not being critical of anybody, but I think it is very important to have evidence to back up a statement. Because if we're using anecdotal evidence to apply to a large population, that can be particularly harmful.
Great. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome, Andrew. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Over to line 4, and John in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi. I'm fine. How are you?
Not bad. I got some information to ask you. Can you tell me what is cancer and what can be done to treat it if you get diagnosed?
Well, cancer is a very broad topic, John.
Okay.
Cancer is the growth of, essentially, it is normally when the cells in our body reproduce, they have a very controlled way of doing that. So, for example, you cut your skin, you get an initial clot, the skin heals over, you get new skin cells that grow in, and you get a scar that forms, and then it's healed and it stops growing. And the repair is done. It's like patching up something on a building. Once you've patched something up, you stop applying the patch. It's all done.
Right, yeah.
Well, what cancer in and of itself is the growth of cells that do not stop. And so you can have pretty much any cell in the body that will grow. And if the conditions are correct, if the genetics lead to this, if the environmental influences and all the other things that can lead to particular sources of cancer or cancerous change, these cells will continue to grow and they form masses or tumors. And so the treatment for cancers is based on either interfering with the reproduction of the cells, slowing the growth, killing the cells, looking at the genetics to try and change the genetics, using other treatments to attack the cancer cells, have the immune system attack the cancer cells. There are many different approaches to cancer. There are hundreds and hundreds of different types of cancer, which makes it very difficult to have a single treatment for cancer because there's so many different cells that respond in different ways.
Okay, I can get you a specific cancer, then maybe you can narrow it down even better. Prostate cancer. What are the chances of surviving if someone gets that?
Actually, most men will die with prostate cancer, but not because of prostate cancer. Many prostate cancers are slow growing. There are some that are aggressively growing. But if you were to do biopsies on prostate glands of men who have died, say, of heart disease or diabetes or whatever disease, and you do a biopsy, you'll find in many men, especially if they're older, that they already have small areas of their prostate that are cancerous. But the cancer in the prostate isn't what killed them. It's usually some other disease, because many of these prostate cancers are slow growing. That isn't to say that there aren't prostate cancers that lead to harm and can cause death. But in terms of prostate cancer, it's one of those cancers that can be very difficult to determine when to treat and when not to treat, especially when they're very slow growing and when it's detected. So for example, if you find a prostate cancer in a man who's 45 years old, which is rare but can happen, the decision to treat is probably very different than if you find a prostate cancer in a man who's 75 years old, whose lifespan may be another 10 years, and whose prostate cancer may not really cause very much harm over the next 10 years. So there is an issue of a person's age, the type of tumor, how fast it grows, the size of the tumor, and the treatment of prostate cancer, especially in younger men, can result in a lot of what we call morbidity. That is, they may end up with urinary problems, chronic pain when they urinate, sexual dysfunction. Their quality of life may suffer by removing that cancer, which may be small and slow growing, and then they have many years of suffering as a result of treating that cancer, which may or may not have caused them harm. So it's not a black and white issue when treating cancer. It's individualized for the patient depending on the many factors that will contribute either to determining whether this cancer is harmful over the long term or whether it can be treated more as a chronic disease and kept under control and provide a better quality of life for someone.
Okay, I got a question to ask you. I'm 44 years old, so what are the chances of me getting certain types of cancers? Is it rare? Is it possible?
Well, John, if you want to hang on, we're going to just take a small break and then I can answer that question for you. Okay, so we're going to put John on hold, and then when we get back, we have John who will answer that question with cancer risk, Linda in Ottawa who would like to discuss back pain, and Des in Barrhaven would like to discuss the antibiotic Cipro. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and back with your calls in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
To the phone lines. And actually, before the back to the phones, we had a request from a listener to repeat the medication I was talking to Maria about with regards to anxiety that is much less habit-forming. In fact, it's not habit-forming at all. Less risk of tolerance as well. And it's called Buspirone. 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 It's been out for a long, long time. It does tend to work reasonably well. There are other medications as well for anxiety that can be used that also are less habit-forming, just like Buspirone. But it really requires you to speak to your doctor or psychiatrist to discuss various ways to treat anxiety. We're going to go back to John. And John, as you were saying, you're 44 years old, and the question was, what cancers are you at risk for?
Yeah, I just want to know what other chances am I going to get it. I haven't had it all my life yet, mm-hmm. which is very good. I want to know what are the chances now, and if I do, what are the chances of living?
Well, again, when determining outcomes and trying to predict whether someone's going to have a disease or not, that's virtually impossible to do. Okay, what we can do, though, is there are various screening tests that are done at a specific age and also depending on family history that can be helpful. So, for example, we do colon cancer screening at age 50. Usually we do a colonoscopy to look at the colon. If the colon has no polyps and is clear, usually what the gastroenterologist will say is that there's no need to do another colonoscopy for at least another 10 years, which means that you know that over the long term, it's less likely for you to develop colon cancer, which is a very common cancer. If you don't smoke, your risk of lung cancer is extremely low. Your risk of other cancers, such as bladder cancer, which happens with smoking amongst others, is also very low. You won't get heart disease as much if you're not a smoker. If you're eating very well and you're not eating junk food for the most part, if you're eating lots of fruits and vegetables, you're exercising, you will tend to reduce your risk of chronic diseases by about 25 years. So that instead of developing diabetes at 50, you may not ever develop diabetes, and then the heart disease and all the other things that happen at an early age.
Well, I'm that close.
So, in terms of prostate cancer, well, I can tell you that most men will develop prostate cancer in their lifetime. It's quite high. But at the same time, many men won't die because of the prostate cancer. They'll usually die of heart disease or kidney disease or some other illness before they die of prostate cancer. Okay. So in terms of the cancers at age 44, it's pretty low right now, John, at least for the next, 10 or 20 years. Pretty low.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Doctor.
You're very welcome, John.
No problem. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye now. And good afternoon to Linda in Ottawa. Hello, Linda.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
I'm calling about my son, actually.
Okay.
He is 30 years old, and 2 years ago, he developed upper back pain in his right shoulder blade area.
Okay.
He's very sportsy, always played sports. So for 2 years, it's changed his lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
He's been to many doctors, chiro, lots of physio, lots of acupuncture. He's recently had x-rays done, and he's recently had an MRI done.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is fine. There's nothing. So he is going in May to a physiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just wondering if there's anything else we should be looking for. If the physiatrist finds nothing, any idea why somebody's back would begin to hurt like that and basically change his lifestyle. So he's unable to play sports.
Mm-hmm.
If he tries, he's not in constant pain. He's in a little discomfort, but if he tries to play sports, he gets in very bad pain.
And it's always in that same location.
Well, it was, yes. It would go right across to the left side. Now, if he tries to throw a ball or anything with his left arm, mm-hmm. he gets a sharp pain.
Right.
Most of the time, I think it's just a discomfort type of pain. Something new that just happened a few weeks ago was he started doing his practicum for Teachers College.
Mm-hmm.
So he was leaning over desks. By the end of that first week of practicum, he developed really swollen muscles down the two sides of the spine,
mm-hmm.
in those back muscles. They swelled up, and he had to take a day off and ice his back all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something new.
Yeah, that may be something completely apart, though, from the shoulder just because of the position that he was in, because it's common for people to develop that kind of back pain if they're leaning over a desk.
Right.
However, it sounds like you've been extremely thorough with regards to evaluating the back. What strikes me, though, it's the focus has been on the actual muscle tissue, right? Because if he's injured his back, especially around the shoulder blade, you have to think of the rhomboid muscles, which are the ones that attach to the shoulder blade in sort of the from the spine towards the shoulder blade itself. But if he continues to have pain in that area, the other consideration, and the physiatrist may be able to test for this, is actually to look at the innervation of that area. There may have been, from the injury that he had, he may have a nerve that has just been compressed or damaged. It could be a cutaneous nerve. It could be a small little nerve branch to the muscle itself that is causing this kind of pain. And you're not going to find that by doing imaging studies or MRIs or x-rays. It's just not going to show up because the nerve is too small and it just doesn't show up on those kind of scans.
Okay.
What can be helpful is actually, it's called electromyograms or EMGs, which will look at nerve conduction in various parts of the body to see if there's anything going on. The other is sometimes you can have what's an interventional radiologist who will help try to pinpoint exactly where the pain is, and then through either ultrasound guidance or fluoroscopy, they sometimes will inject a small amount of anesthetic into the area that hurts the most to see if it takes the pain away. And if it does take the pain away, that helps determine that, you know, if he gets that shot, right, and it's harmless to do, it really is, because it's just a local anesthetic that lasts about an hour and a half. If it takes the pain away, that gives you a clue to a diagnosis that instead of the muscle being the main culprit for this, it may be some tissue around the muscle or the nerve itself that is damaged. And then the next steps would be to potentially either ablate the nerve, if that was the case, or anesthetize the nerve over the long term, which is what the interventional radiologist can do. That may provide him with a lot of relief. So again, what it seems to strike me as is that the focus has been just on the tissue, and I don't know if they've considered the nerve itself in that area that could be possibly damaged.
Okay.
So that's what I would suggest is to have him speak to his physician about thinking about the nerve itself and perhaps even a local anesthetic in the area that hurts the most. Okay. I do that with my patients sometimes. I'll say, it hurts right here. I said, okay, well, let's see what happens. When I give you this, does it give you relief? And if it gives them complete relief, then you move on to the next step of saying, okay, what can we do to make this more permanent in that area?
Okay.
Good luck, Linda.
Well, all right. Thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And my apologies to Des in Barrhaven. We have about 20 seconds left. My thanks to Sebastian Tremblay for producing Sunday House Call. And we'll be back again next week, next Sunday, with another edition. You've been listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.